patio at my parents' house, and we're just jamming away, and the place is packed. There's people jumping off the roof, you know, into the pool, and there's beer bottles. We got a couple kegs flowing, and I mean, it was a good time. But then my parents came home, and they're all,
were they just not in the spirit of things?
Huh? Well, I tell you, that's what I thought until, you know, my mom got done talking to me, but I looked over, and my dad's in the living room dancing with all these blonde girls, and I'm going, party's it's still going, man.
All right, Dad.
We were a mess. Yeah, we were a mess. I know we didn't go overseas because, you know, the management just said, you know, you guys go and somebody's not coming back. Or if they do, they're coming back in a body bag. You know, we were operating like a punk band. We were completely out of control. Hey, this is Nikki Six of Motley Crue in the studio with Motley Crue's Greatest Hits.
It's inconceivable that Motley Crue would form anywhere else other than L.A.'s Sunset Strip rock clubs that 30 years ago included the Whiskey, the Roxy, and Starwood as boiling points of volcanic rock activity. Recruited for Motley Crue were high school drummer Tommy Lee Bass, Midwestern transplant Bob Deal, the self-described rude, crude, aggressive guitarist whose stage name morphed into Mick Mars, suburban cover band singer Vince Neil Wharton, and bass player-songwriter Nikki Six, who had grown up in Seattle as Frank Ferrano, chilled his teenage passions at his grandparents in Idaho, and eventually rode a Greyhound bus to the Sunset Strip.
But there was a little time there, you know, that first Van Halen album, and that's not fabricated. That's so real. The first, you know, few Kiss albums. I mean, that first record to me is as real as it gets. Ramones, great, great band. Pistols' first record. And people can go in and try and fabricate parts of it and say, well, this would be the perfect bass player, this would be the perfect thing. But you can smell it and taste it when it's real.
Recalling a series of Southern California rock events that would spawn his singing career, here's Motley Crue's Vince Neil.
They had these things out there, the concerts called the California Jam.
Oh, yeah. Ozzy and Nugent.
And Aerosmith. Heart. And it would be like 3 days at Ontario Motor Speedway. And, you know, you'd go in the parking lot, and you would go like 2 days early to the concert and then party in your car. You know, and even the helicopters would be flying over your head, you know.
Bringing in bands and bringing them out.
And you just know that those people are in that helicopter, you know. And it just the excitement of it all. And it was just great.
Tearing, I've been tempted by his lack, is a knife in your baggage rage.
Motley Crue's 1983 second album, Shout at the Devil, was in sharp contrast to the sounds dominating the sales chart from The Police, Journey, Eurythmics, John Mellencamp, and Huey Lewis at the time. Here's Motley Crue bass player, songwriter, Nikki Sixx.
Shout at the Devil, what the were we thinking? Spring of 83, didn't care, didn't want to hear about it, didn't want to know about it, anything else other than just what we do. And we, you know, lived it, breathed it 24 hours a day. And the concept of charts and Billboard magazine, and to be honest with you, I probably didn't even know about it. It's, you know, some reason the rock terminology, you know, the name rock, it comes in and out of fashion. You know, I remember about 3 or 4 years ago, it wasn't cool to be rock. Now everything's rock. You know, you see AC/DC underwear. You know, it's like, damn, man. It's, you know, but, you know, it's funny because whenever rock and roll like rears its head again, everyone's like, it's back. I'm like, you know, it never really went away. It's always been there. And it's very blue collar and it's very real. And we were, you know, just a bunch of guys who believed in what we believed in. And we didn't really look too far into the future. And I don't really believe that, you know, we could have seen what was about to happen. If it would have been premeditated, it would have never happened. You know, at the time, we were really serious about what we were doing and what we looked like and what we sounded like and what the lyrics were about and what the band was about and the live performance. And it was every single time we're going for the sack, every single time. Guys like Mick Mars, as quiet and docile and sweet of a person he is a monster inside. And it comes out through his guitar.
It wasn't that much earlier that Vince Neil had made his performing debut. It wasn't exactly professional, but it was memorable.
I remember my first gig.
You remember your first gig?
Yeah, it was in my parents' house. Yeah. First time I ever sang in front of anybody. I was in a band called Rock Candy. And
great name for a band after the Montrose song.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
yeah, killer
song.
Great
song.
Yeah. So you were in a band called Rock Candy playing at your parents' house.
Well, my parents went. I thought they were going out of town for the night.
You were hoping.
So I had this small party of about 500 people.
Just 500 intimate close friends.
And we're in the patio of my parents' house, and we're just jamming away, and place is packed. There's people jumping off the roof, you know, into the pool, and there's beer bottles. We had a couple kegs flowing, and I mean, it was a good time. But then my parents came home, and they're all,
were
Vince?
They just not in the spirit of things? Huh?
Well, I tell you, that's what I thought, until... You know, my mom got done talking to me, but I looked over, and my dad's in the living room dancing with all these blonde girls, and I'm going, party's it's still going, man.
All right, Dad.
The song Looks the Kill makes me feel like I'm going 100 miles per hour when I'm sitting still. From Motley Crue's 1983 double platinum Shout at the Devil album, the band scored the opening slot on a major tour, and Nikki Sixx remembers them getting schooled in Rock Band 101.
We were opening for Ozzy, and it was Portland, Maine, I think. And the first show, you know, we go out there, we play, we come back, we trash the dressing room, we, you know, have an orgy, we do a bunch of drugs, and we write all over the walls with whatever we can get, you know, markers, ketchup bottles. And this guy comes back and goes, "You guys are going to clean this up." We're like, "Fuck you, dude. You clean it up. That's your job. You're a janitor." And he's like, "No, you clean it up or you're not getting paid." Oh, our manager comes to us and goes, "Well, this is the way it works. If you guys don't clean it up, they're going to clean it up. They clean it up, you're going to pay for it." And that was sort of like the beginning of like, well, so this is the real world? Because, you know, we would like, you know, go get drunk and kick in the side of cars and, you know, just total skateboard, bonehead, marine, jarhead, redneck stuff. And, you know, it's like Animal House on 10. And you get into the real world and, you know, you go into the record company's office and you pee in the corner and all of a sudden you get a bill for it. And we're like, wow, $700? All I did was pee on the wall. Woo! Yeah, don't seem to have one of those days when everyone's on your case, from your teacher all the way down to your best girlfriend. Well, you know, I used to have just about all the time, but I found a way to get out of it. Let me tell you about sitting in a classroom thinking it's a drag. Listening to the teacher rap just in my bag. By the two bells ring, you know it's my cue. I'm gonna meet the boys on floor number 2.
Smoking in the Boys Room was Motley Crue's cover of the Brownsville Station song. Coming up next, Nikki Sixx reveals long-term fallout from a fatal car crash, trial, and verdict. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and for more, you can visit inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, with Nikki Sixx and Vince Neil, for the best of Motley Crue.
Hey, this is Nikki Sixx of Motley Crue in the studio with Motley Crue's greatest hits.
Thanks, Nikki. I'm Redbeard. Motley Crue's newly found national popularity was severely tested beginning in December 1984 when lead singer Vince Neil, drinking and driving, was involved in a fatal car crash which killed his passenger, Nicholas Razzle Dingley, the drummer of the band Hanoi Rocks. Nikki Sixx will never forget getting the news.
I was in Martinique, and I was with Robin Crosby, and Niels Lozar, our photographer. Robin Crosby is the lead guitar player from Rat. We were down there, been on tour for a long time, and everybody needed a break, and I think that was probably one of my first vacations. And when I landed in Miami, a guy ran up to me and said, "Your singer's dead. A member of your gang is dead. The gang doesn't exist anymore." You know, that's how important my band was to me. And I was devastated. First phone call I made, management said, "No, Vince isn't dead. The guy that was in the car is dead." So then, you know, we dealt with it from there. But that first moment, being the kid that came from Idaho to Hollywood on a Greyhound, it's over. Just went from paradise to hell in, like, you know, the time it takes to walk off an airplane. That changed the band. That really did change the band. I know that made us grow up, at least on some levels. You know, it was real. You mean people die from this stuff? You mean it's not okay to do that? You know, we all do that. I remember saying at the time somebody was coming down on Vince for drinking and driving, and I was like, "Dude, I see you drink and drive every day. And so do I, by the way. And so does everybody that we know. We all go to the Rainbow, we get plastered, we pick up bimbos, and we drive home." Like, "Yeah, you're right." I go, Maybe this was meant to happen for a reason, you know, and in a lot of ways, as sad as it is that somebody died, maybe a lot of people's lives were saved, because I know that around that time, people started becoming really aware of it.
You know I'm a dreamer, but my heart's of gold. I had a runaway high, so I wouldn't come home low. Just when things went right, it doesn't mean they were take this song and you'll never be left all alone. Take me to your heart, fill me in your bones. Just one more night and I'm coming on this lonely, winding road. I'm on my way, I'm on my way, home sweet home.
Tonight, I'm on my way, home sweet home.
verse of Home Sweet Home I had when I was about 17 years old. And I remember showing it to Tommy one day, and there was a big piano, and Tommy's always loved piano. He was like playing the piano, and I said, hey, check this out. And I started playing, you know, the opening chords on acoustic guitar, and I says, play that. And he came up with this, that part, you know. And also, you have to remember, that wasn't the formula. That wasn't the, as the Mr. Industry would say, the business plan of rock and roll at the time. You know, bands didn't have a power ballad, you know, in an MTV as a vehicle to have a hit. I mean, that just wasn't the way it was. I mean, after Home Sweet Home, you saw every band had the one ballad. It came as their second or third single. I mean, it's the same crap. Plus, we just did Shout at the Devil, Looks That Kill. If anything, I think that probably the reason we did it was because it was so anti-Motley Crue. And it's funny because it threw us into the mainstream. And none of us had the foresight. Trust me, none of us had the foresight to see that.
That was Home Sweet Home composer Nikki Sixx of Motley Crue. That song was a trendsetter as one of the first MTV power ballad videos, coming from Motley Crue's 1985 Theater of Pain album. Motley Crue lead singer Vince Neil's conviction for vehicular manslaughter carried with it 20 days in jail and a whopping $2,600,000 fine. But the lengthy court case had also imposed a sentence of sort with the other members of Motley Crue, according to Nikki Sixx.
The band for the first time didn't all live together, either on a tour bus, in a hotel, or in an apartment in Hollywood. Everybody had their own places. I remember Vince lived like in Huntington Beach, which to me, I was like, the beach? How can you go to the beach? You're in leather. I didn't get the concept that people go, you want to go to the beach? I'm like, why? You know, I'm a rocker, man. I rock. This is what I do. I live and breathe it 24 hours a day. And, you know, I was like, oh, yeah, you're allowed to have fun, too. But, you know, that's how serious I was. That Vince was like, you know, the kind of a surfer guy. And he loved it down there. And I live in Hollywood. And Tommy lived right around the corner from me. And Mick actually did live by the beach, but I don't think he knew it. Because he didn't get out much. But, you know, we'd kind of, that at that time, you know, I remember me and Tommy becoming so tight. We hung out every single day and we did stuff on all different kinds of levels, mostly just reckless abandon, you know. And Vince was down in his world and there was a separation there. There was a separation there, you know. The other thing is, because Vince wasn't a writer in the band, so to speak, it wasn't important for us to bring him in to write music. So music was written, you know, at my apartment or by other band members. And then we would get together and rehearse. And then we'd show Vince the music. And then he'd put his stamp on it, which is his vocal sound, right? And became Motley Crue. But if he had been an active songwriter, probably we wouldn't have separated so much. But I really feel at that time that there was a separation between Vince and the band. You know, he became reclusive, dealing with all that stuff, and we were still on the warpath.
Right. through the gears in their tale of their favorite scenic locations. Motley Crue with the title song to 1987's Girls, Girls, Girls album, which hit number 2 on the sales charts and sold over 4 million copies. Still to come, the band makes history in the former Soviet Union, scores a number 1 selling album, and the band members nearly fail to survive the experience. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and you can certainly find a whole lot more at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, in the studio with Nikki Sixx and Vince Neil of Motley Crue for their greatest hits.
Hey, this is Nikki Sixx of Motley Crue in the studio with Motley Crue's greatest hits.
Thank you once again, Nikki. I'm Redbeard. The subsequent 100-city Girls, Girls, Girls North American tour nearly sold out in advance. But a hint of internal problems was the fact that Motley Crue canceled the European leg of their tour. Here's Nikki Sixx.
Everybody was on different wavelengths. Tommy had met Heather Locklear, so he was in, like, you know, a whole different realm. I'm like down the street, you know, in the gutter with all the junkies, and he's up the street in the mansion with all the actors and movie stars. Mick is a recluse, and Vince, you know, kind of was like, he loves strip clubs. That's his thing. Strip clubs and hanging out. Vince has never changed. I think that we were just really became 4 different people, but it came across in the music, you know, that way too. And you go back to Girls, Girls, Girls. I remember being in the studio, not showing up for days at a time. And then when I would show up in the studio, everyone would be completely wasted, or I'd be the bad guy. I'd have syringes in my cowboy boots, and I'd pull them out and shoot up in the bathroom so no one could look. And in the mornings, I'd have to go to methadone clinics, you know, just so I could not shoot up so much during the day so I wouldn't get sick. And, you know, extreme alcoholism. You know, there's a lot of talk of drugs and stuff, but the thing is, Motley Crue is an extremely hard drinking band. You know, when you drink as hard as we drank, we, you know, tend to have a lot of reckless things that happen along with it. I just think this band is so funny. It's like, if there's a pile of dog shit, this band's going to step in it. You know, we were operating like a punk band. We were completely out of control.
Can you see that? Toss 3 wires, religion, greed,
reporting in from the wild side. By this point, Motley Crue was, as put by James Christopher Morgan on AllMusic.com, and I quote, "the audio equivalent of sex, drugs, and rock and roll, a group that not only loved the scene, but lived it like Vikings storming a sleepy village." Again, Motley Crue bass player, songwriter, Nikki Six.
You know, you become sort of this person that goes, I wonder what it would be like to, you know, drive a Bentley into a swimming pool. I can't do that now, you know, but it's amazing to me. You know, you start to get the realities of stuff. And, you know, then as you get farther into it, you start going like, so if we have 100 things that blow up every night, we're going to go home with no money. And if we have 75 things that go blow up every night, we're going to go home with a little bit of money. At one point in your career, you go, I don't care. Then later, you know, you go, wow, man, the Dr. Feelgood tour at the time, 1989, $325,000 a week to break even. So we're, you know, $1.2 million a month, and we're gone for 15 months. So, you know, we spent about $20 million just entertaining. So anything after that was ours. And, you know, that's like part of the thing where you go, wow, man, you need a better business plan. What's your exit strategy? Pee in the corner and blow everything up.
By the close of the 1980s, concepts of freedom and self-determination, human rights, and democracy were sprouting through the seams of the Iron Curtain in the Soviet bloc countries of Eastern Europe. In August 1989, Motley Crue was one of several bands invited to perform at the Moscow Music Peace Festival. Here's Motley Crue lead singer Vince Neil.
It was Lenin Stadium. It's what they built it for the Moscow Olympics. So when they had the Olympics over there, so wow. It was huge, huge place.
I mean, how many does it hold?
It held 100,000. It was a lot of people.
And it was full.
It was full both nights.
Two nights.
2 days.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, we did two shows, the same show.
Do you remember when this was first presented to you? What did you think?
Actually, I didn't think it was going to happen.
And why?
You know, well, because I mean, trying to get this many rock and roll bands over to Russia and like where metal music anyway is like the devil's music and all that, you know.
It's kind of like certain parts of America.
So, you know, people like Billy Joel go over there and it's cool, but not, you know, yeah, not Motley Crue. I mean, well, you can't really make any money over there anyway. You can't take rubles out of the country. That's why this charity thing worked, because all the money that was generated through ticket sales and merchandising, t-shirts sold at the gig, all went to a foundation set up for the Soviet Union.
Do they have a lot of the same problems that we have, with drugs and alcohol and stuff like that in the Soviet Union too?
Dude, where do you think they make vodka?
That's right.
Stoli, yeah.
Soon, Motley Crue's Dr. Feelgood album would go number 4 in the UK and bona fide number 1 in the US and Canada, and to date has sold more than 6 million copies. It was an overwhelming vote of confidence for the clean and sober band members, but understandably, a challenge nevertheless.
Getting off the plane from Russia and people going, your album's number 1. I mean, I was in Russia with all these messed up, dysfunctional motherfuckers and being lied to by management. And I was in this depressed place and, you know, just kind of in that muck. And landing in New York City and finding out that you're the king and the top of your game. I know that there was a time in there when it was a blur, a complete blur of drug addiction. I'm so thankful that we didn't have the marketing and the ability to get information across the globe that we have now. Because if I had been in my house with such a huge heroin and cocaine problem that I was on the verge of death, paranoia and insanity, and I had a computer, who knows what would have happened. And also that if other people could have visited me, that did visit me, and could have done more than go to the cat house on Thursday night and go, man, I was at Nikki's house, he's f***ed up. You post that on the internet and it's worldwide in newspapers, on radio shows, you know. So in a sense, you're right. The world didn't know what was really going on. And I wasn't even aware that the world was going on. I was just doing what I do. And then we got clean and we made a record. And then all of a sudden, there it is. It just happened. On top of everything and everybody, and everyone's looking, and everything you touch turns to platinum. That's for a guy like me who grew up wanting to be William Burroughs, you know, as a writer, or a guy like me who thought, you know, Lou Reed and Ian Hunter are my, you know, they're my Bob Dylans. That's an uncomfortable place to be. You know, it was very hard for me to accept a home and a wife and children and friends, the phone that doesn't ring after 9 o'clock at night, you know, used to wake up at 9 o'clock at night. So that was an interesting period for me as a human being. I mean, it's so wonderful, but at the same time, I remember not being very comfortable in my skin about a lot of stuff and being pissed. I was pissed because it was working. And there was I'm telling you, there's the period coming out of the cocoon that is uncomfortable. And it wasn't for Tommy. Tommy was like, yeah, man, I'm married to Heather Locklear. I got a number one album. That's great. You know, Tommy was always so fun. The funnest guy in the world. I mean, Tommy, just everybody loved Tommy. Tommy is a big kid, great. Vince, you know, just, you know, the girls, he loved women. You know, Mick, reclusive but happy, you know, feeling content, feeling like, you know, I showed them, you know, and feeling pretty proud. And me feeling like, oh my God, what is going on? Was an interesting time for me. I mean, there was a time after that when I became like, wow, I feel kind of like a human being. Kind of felt like I was coming down a little bit and I could like, could breathe a little bit. I could be like, wow, so this is life. This is what it's like to watch Monday Night Football without a syringe in your arm. Wow, this is interesting.
We'll be right back. Vince Neil would leave Motley Crue for 5 long years in the 90s while changing music styles, disease, deaths, more celebrity marriages and divorces, reality TV shows, and prison for drummer Tommy Lee would keep the fireworks going. But 2008's Crue Fest, featuring all 4 original members, was the summer's top moneymaker. Motley Crue completed another residency this past October at the Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas, Vince Neil's current home, sweet home. And the notorious Motley Crue tell-all book, The Dirt, Confessions of the World's Most Notorious Rock Band, will become a full-length biopic film directed by Jackass series filmmaker Jeff Tremaine. Singer Vince Neil assesses the status Crue.
I think we really realize we screwed up.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, let's just be honest here.
We are being honest.
You know, I mean, we make really good music when we're apart, but, you know, we make great music when we're together. It's just the 4 of us, we're like a machine, you know, and it just works really well when all the parts are there. And it'll still run when one wheel's off, but it'll run a lot better with all 4.
I'm Redbeard, back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests Nikki Six and Vince Neil. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2014. All rights reserved. Transcriptions by Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. For this and more, visit inthestudio.net.